This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. It used to be that American cultural influence spread across the world with the help of movie theaters, compact discs, and records. Now it's downloads and websites. Illinois State University political scientist Lane Crowther specializes in the study of globalization. A new edition of his book, Globalization and American Popular Culture, looks at the growth and global scope of social media.
We, of course, often think predominantly in terms of groups like Facebook, and with good reason. Facebook has, what, 1.7, 1.8 billion independent monthly users at this point in time. If it was a country, it would be the largest country in the world. But we're not the only one. The Chinese have built their own social media system. There are other competing social media systems out there. And of course, there's other kind of more specialized or niche systems available. And what this has done is interlink people around the world into communities in which their actual geographic location no longer matters. All that matters is, are they a member of this same digital group or digital orbit of groups where these kinds of ideas are shared and these kind of experiences are shared?
So that would, I guess, tend to promote the idea of all physicists get together and all poets get together and all filmmakers get together. But how does it impact the popular culture?
Well, you have to, and there's a couple of different answers to that question, so forgive me if this goes on for a while. The first one is, if you just think about it in terms of raw programming terms, there's an enormous numbers of channels, of digital resources, of devices and products seeking your attention, right? We've built what's being called the attention economy, right, where the real thing that everybody's fighting for is your eyeballs. They're fighting for your eyeballs for advertising purposes, for perhaps propaganda purposes, as we think regarding the Russians, right? And so they're fighting for that, and they need to fill that time, and they need to fill that space, and it's, in fact, completely unfillable, right? Because it's endless. It's not like the old days when you and I were kids and television went off the air at midnight and you could watch the color bars and the Star Spangled Banner and that was it, right? It's endless. One of the great advantages, if you are someone in the business of appealing for attention, one of the great advantages of American popular culture, whether you've licensed it legally, whether you've created it, or you are pirating it, is that there's a vast amount of it already readily available for you to use and to put out there on whatever platform you're seeking to put it out. Moreover, that product, that whether it's movies, music, television, fast food, clothing, whatever it is, has already been globally tested and found to be globally appealing. Right? We already know that it's popular in a lot of places around the world, and we already know that it's popular in places that we're politically not connected to very closely, right? American popular culture, American television programs and movies are every bit as popular in Iran as they are in the United States, right? It's not it doesn't matter that the governments don't get along.
Isn't there still a tendency, though, to pay attention to the economics? If the Chinese are doubling down in Africa, won't some African nations be more disposed to pick up Chinese cultural products than U.S. cultural products?
Well, that's one of the great questions that's out there. And since this process is unfolding, we don't know. It's a little bit easier. I can't speak enough about the kind of Chinese products that are available and what their structure and nature are. But let's put it in terms of something like Bollywood. Bollywood, the Indian movie industry, makes far more movies than the United States does every year, or they get made by whatever we might call Hollywood, however broadly you want to define that term.
And you can see some of them at Marcus Theaters in Bloomington Normal.
Exactly right. And they're fun, and they are what they are. But they're also, so far at least, still pretty significantly niche programs embedded in a particular cultural point of view. That culture is spreading. That culture is embedding its people all over the world, as we're finding in Bloomington Normal or whatever else. So it may. But so far, at least, it hasn't become the kind of globally pervasive, globally popular product that American popular culture has proved itself to be. So you have that just broad question about an appealing channel. Are there competitors? Are there areas where it's not competitive? All of that is true. But on average, it's more competitive, it's more globally appealing, and it's been that way for about a century now. In fact, I was in Istanbul about a year ago, a little over a year ago, giving a talk, and I started my talk with the question, how come I don't know anything about Turkish popular culture, but you know a lot about American popular culture? And what was very interesting was their response. The audience laughed. because it apparently seemed absurd to them that I would know anything about Turkish popular culture. And it's perfectly obvious why they know everything about American popular culture, right? Because of its global presence and its global pervasiveness. And yet Turkish and the Turkic languages are one of the most commonly spoken group of languages in the world. All those places that Americans don't ever talk about, Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan and, you know, all those people, they're all Turkic language speaking people. Nonetheless, you have that kind of global appeal. So that, I would argue, is one thing that seems to provide it a tool or a mechanism to be globally pervasive.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with ISU Professor of Politics and Government Lane Crothers about globalization and American popular culture. It may be that, as you say, you know, the last 100 years have been pretty good for American cultural products, but it does not necessarily follow that past success is the prologue. It gives a competitive advantage because it's known, but economic hegemony is eroding, so why wouldn't cultural hegemony erode?
I wouldn't deny the possibility. I mean, unfortunately, not that good at telling the future, and if I was, my stock portfolio would be better than it is. What I can say is that there has to be a product or a group of products or a package of products that is also as appealing. And at present, that's not true for most people and most cultural products. And particularly because American popular culture is either deliberately or accidentally, it doesn't matter which, associated with the broad patterns of what people think about the United States to begin with, right? Which is that it's relatively free and that it's relatively rich and that you have the opportunity to build a certain kind of life in this country in a way that is clearly not the case in China. And so while China might build you a great road and China might build you a great harbor, I don't think very many people globally right now are aspiring to the sociocultural structure of China. Now, that may change. The world is a big and complicated place, and Lord knows we're going through our populist moment right now where authoritarianism is rising, but there you are.
Well, that's the next question, is how is that populist rage and that populist rightist moment on the global stage affecting the perception of American cultural products?
That is such a wonderful question, and I can find no evidence that it's changed anything. But let me say that advisedly. What I mean by that is there's always been a tension, right? That is, while the products are broadly appealing, they're also always problematic in the eyes of a number of figures. And so you can take an easy one, right? The French have always been ambiguous about American popular culture or uncertain because, of course, it's packaged in English. And they have worked over time to try to protect French as a language and put a number of cultural barriers up to try to reduce the impact of American popular culture. That's right. The mixing of French and English language. And at one point in time, one of the more interesting examples was they sued Georgia Tech because Georgia Tech put an ad up on the internet for an online program. And that ad appeared in France. It wasn't on a server in France. It wasn't aimed at France, but it appeared in France. And Georgia Tech got sued. France sued Georgia Tech because the ad wasn't in French. And more broadly, if you look at the broad question over time, whether it was in the old days when we had a general agreement on tariffs and trade, GATT, and today under the World Trade Organization's, culture is one of the major areas in cultural products where countries are still allowed to put trade barriers up and protect their domestic culture-producing institutions, mostly there to protect them from being either outcompeted or simply purchased by wealthy American providers. And the United States' position has been throughout almost all that period that that's wrong and we should just have open and free competition in these ideas. Moreover, it's not just about, you know, fear that American products and American companies will come in and overwhelm. It's also the case that popular culture is particularly interesting and particularly intriguing to younger people. Which also, and to the degree that cultural products bear the imprint of the culture that produces them or that created them in their initial stages, then if you're an established elderly person in Iran, say, and all of a sudden your 14-year-old daughter is singing hip-hop songs to herself, you are very likely to perceive that as a significant problem. And I think useful to remember, in the United States, we're really used to all these new cultural products and new ideas, and we're used to trends, and we're used to people being different in terms of how they dress and how they behave. And we still get upset about some of these cultural changes and some of these cultural products.
Especially when we start to age out of currency.
Absolutely correct. That said, you can only then imagine – what somebody who's not as used to it, who's not as embedded in it, looks at, and they look at what they think is the dying of their culture as the youth get corrupted by some other agency.
Well, since the digital era is well and truly underway then, and the borders and feet on the ground don't matter as much as they used to, how is the resistance to American cultural products from the older generations or the more traditionalist portion of those populaces, how is that taking shape? Is it becoming more desperate? Is it becoming more angsty or more militant? What's happening?
Well, I think, you know, and a couple of useful examples here. You can look at a case like Iran, which has made satellite dishes illegal and made a number of other different kind of mechanisms by which often American popular cultural products make it into their country they've sought to control. From all accounts, every house in Iran has a satellite dish on it. So there's a gap between the rhetoric and the actual practice. And it's kind of that classic hypocritical nudge, wink. We'll let them have their say, and then we'll go live the lives we want to lead. And
I'll get Uncle Benny to install it. Yeah.
Something, you know, just to get it done, right? So there's that approach. The other approach is more like the Chinese approach. And the Chinese invest enormous amounts of money and enormous amounts of effort and enormous numbers of people monitoring the internet. They spend an enormous amount of time blocking certain kind of searches and blocking certain kind of phrases and making sure that only certain channels of information are available to them, either by, it's called the Great Wall of China. It's considered this blocking mechanism, either in the sense that they have real-time monitors, or they make a contract with somebody like Google or Apple or Microsoft with Bing, and they say, if you want to operate in this country, you need to automatically block certain kind of searches and therefore try to exclude entire classes of information from their people.
As success, not success?
You know, it depends. As technological things go, for a long time, apparently, the Chinese system wasn't that hard to beat if you went to a VPN client. You installed a VPN client, you presented yourself as from Switzerland or wherever else, and you got everything you wanted. I gather that in recent years, the Chinese have gotten better at shutting that down. Being an American, I tend to believe that in the end, people's creativity on the rules are far more powerful than the enforcer of rules, right? That if you give people enough time and enough creativity, they'll figure out a way to break almost any rule and get what they want.
7 years ago, you wrote an article for the Huffington Post talking about how you thought that American cultural products were going to do very nicely in the digital age. And that has continued to happen. You are correct, sir.
What, once in a while.
What hadn't you anticipated in the last 7 years that came as a surprise when you were doing this book?
I think really the biggest thing that I've gotten is the degree to which the gap between, one is the gap between what governments want and what the culture does. Right. It's kind of like the speed limit. Right. And which almost everybody treats the speed limit as a speed minimum. And you get mad at people who actually go at or near the speed limit. So there's always this ginormous gap between what the people are into and what the people are going to do. And then the question is, how aggressively does the government seek to try to repress or control it? So that's one, and really trying to tease that out. The other one has been, and I'm not sure I was surprised by this, but at least I've been forced to confront it. I am convinced that most Americans believe that most of the world wants to be American. Right, that they want to have American values and an American lifestyle. And I think most of the rest of the world just likes the stuff we produce. But they wish to continue to be whoever they are. And teasing that out and really often trying to help Americans see that their worldview is more insulated than they think it is. Often is important. I remember being at the Colosseum in Rome one time, and the person taking tickets was speaking to people in like seven different languages. And I was like, if you have to speak seven different languages to be a ticket taker, that's a very different kind of society than we have in the United States, where we complain if somebody speaks Spanish.
Lane Crothers is a professor of politics and government at Illinois State University. His book is Globalization and American Popular Culture. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Thanks as well to Ryan Denham and Mary Cullen today. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.